Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
We will continue on a remorseless mission to squeeze Russia from the global economy piece by piece, day by day, and week by week.
One thing, of course, we could also do is to make an open and unconditional offer to Ukrainian refugees to house them in the United Kingdom.
We haven't seen all of what Putin's going to do at the moment. We do not know what his end goal is.
You're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And good afternoon, I'm Caroline Hepke. Coming up on today's programme, Lord Grimston, the UK minister tasked with securing inward investment for the UK, joins us from Davos. With inflation hitting 9% and the UK economy contracting in March, how do investors view the prospects for Britain?
The Chancellor Rishi Sunak is unveiling a package of measures to help ease the cost of living crisis, the spending set to be partly paid for by a windfall tax on the profits of oil and gas companies. This announcement comes as Boris Johnson's government seeks to move on from the damning Sue Gray report into illegal lockdown parties at Downing Street.
And as the dispute between the UK government and the EU rumbles on over the Northern Ireland Protocol, we're going to be speaking to Carla Lockhart, who is DUP MP for Upper Ban.
Plus, should electric scooters remain on London's roads? Labour's spokesperson on transport in the London Assembly, Ellie Baker, will join us.
Well, now, let's bring in the Minister for Investment, Gerry Grimstone. Lord Grimstone, welcome to the programme. Thank you so much for being with us once more on Bloomberg Radio. You're former chairman of Barclays and Standard Life. You sit in the Lords, of course. Part of your brief is to secure inward investment for the UK. And you're joining us today from the World Economic Forum in Davos. So my first question, how are foreign investors, those that you have met perhaps at Davos, now viewing the UK as an investment destination?
Well, thank you. Of course, I am the UK government's travelling salesman. And if you're a travelling salesman, you need to go where the customers are. And I've been very heartened by the meetings that I've had in Davos. I've met a good number of international investors. And I have to say they're almost universally positive about investing in the UK, particularly in areas such as net zero, where you know that the UK is one of the leaders, and people very interested in offshore wind, onshore wind, carbon capture, hydrogen, very interested in life sciences. Of course, we have an extremely strong R&D base and very interested in technology and fintech and all other forms of tech. So it's been a worthwhile visit, and it's good to be back on the road after COVID.
I'm wondering, with the conversations you're having in Davos with people, when you are, as you say, the UK's travelling salesman, are a lot of people asking you about Partygate and the damage that's done to the British government?
Oh, not really. I mean, these are serious global investors. Of course, not in any way, you know, kind of minimising that topic. But the good thing about having, you know, a portfolio which is focused on investment and you're dealing with, you know, good global professional investors, they look through the day-to-day noise of British politics and are concentrating on, you know, where they can make returns for the future, where is a good place to invest pensioners' money, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, well, on that issue, one of the key questions really is around the package from Rishi Sunak. Of course, we don't know exactly what is going to be in it, but it's been perhaps briefed or at least anticipated by a lot of the media here in the UK. The possibility of a windfall tax on oil and gas companies in the UK. We were speaking to the oil and gas and offshore energy industry yesterday on this programme. They told us that such a windfall would basically damage Britain's investability. Is that how you see it?
Well, look, much though I love the media, I've learned never to anticipate the statements that the Chancellor is going to make. He will be giving details, I'm expecting, you know, later on today about this. I think people understand, investors understand, that we are living in absolutely exceptional times. You know, it is causing a lot of hardship to a lot of people. So look, it's obviously right that the Chancellor is looking at this. But I'm absolutely sure that he, if he does do something today, as I say, I'm not privy to the details of that. I'm absolutely sure that continuing to encourage investment in the UK is going to be one of his top priorities.
Okay. One surely would assume that if this were not part of the package, that it would have been refuted by the government. So the idea of a windfall tax, you know, you have to go back to the 80s to Margaret Thatcher to see that sort of thing having happened before. I suppose I'm just interested in general whether we think that kind of this sort of blueprint of out of the blue last minute taxes on industry in the UK is really beneficial. That surely makes us go down in terms of the estimation of investors abroad.
Well, luckily, I'm not in the business of speculation. All I can say is I've had some, you know, extremely positive interactions with investors during my time at Davos.
Are tax issues coming up in that conversation a lot? Is there, you know, the tax regime in the UK something that investors are attracted to?
Well, they've been really focusing on the investable propositions. You know, there's some really, in my lifetime, I've never seen such opportunities as you're seeing thrown up, for example, by net zero and life sciences. Investors take a long-term view of these things. These are long-term investments. They're long-term investments in matters which are incredibly important to investors, incredibly important part of net zero and the follow-up from COP26. And people are just serious about these things.
Mm-hmm. So the UK government, though, is now investigating a couple of the big deals that are happening here in the UK. So it's Patrick Drahi's investment in BT Group is sort of being given the once over. But also there's an investigation now into the sale of Newport Wafer Fab. Is this, and I'm very interested in your view on this, is this sort of window dressing? Or is there, in your mind, is the UK questioning now Chinese investment into Britain in a serious way?
Well, look, I'm very happy to talk about the experience I've had in Davos. As I've said a couple of times now, I've had extremely positive meetings with investors, you know, all of whom are looking forward to put very substantial money into the UK. I signed with the Qatari government just 2 days ago, and one of our new sovereign investment partnerships, where they're targeting £10 billion investment into the UK over the next 5 years. Mm. And these are the matters that within my portfolio I've been concentrating on.
OK, but then on that very point, there is surely more scrutiny now of sovereign wealth funds investing in the UK when it comes to ESG standards, is there not?
Well, look, I've been on record and I've said a number of times that the UK is very open to investment. We attract investment from all sorts of players, but we're not so stupid as to want to attract harmful investment. So like other countries do, like the US does, of course we scrutinise investments, but we absolutely welcome investment in the UK. Happy to put that on record, but again, it's important that investment isn't detrimental to our interests.
When you're speaking to those investors and they're looking at the long-term prospects for the UK, are they expecting much regulation change as Britain moves away from its relationship with the European Union?
Well, they all look for predictability, particularly for these long-term, you know, 25-year investments. Investors want predictability. It's an important part of our positioning to be predictable. As I say, I've had a very, very good reception.
Is there an element that the a weakness that we've seen in sterling that is kind of returned once more since the kind of lows of the Brexit vote. Is that one a kind of attractive element for foreign buyers to come and kind of snap up investments in the UK at what they might see as a discount?
Well, of course, look, we did go through a period of unpredictability, which you'll be as aware of as I am. A lot of my role in the last couple of years has been restoring predictability. I've got to get back on the road again. I see I've got an investor just waiting to come in for a conversation. So it's been great talking to you. I hope that's been helpful. And if I can just reiterate the message that our whole intention is to make the UK a very attractive place to invest in. And I'm very pleased that you've allowed me to get that message over this morning.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
Well, let's turn our attention now to Brexit and the continuing dispute over the Northern Ireland Protocol. The agreement between the UK government and the EU keeps Northern Ireland in the EU's customs union as well as the UK market. The Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, was visiting County Antrim this week and she said that the problems of the protocol can be solved.
Let's speak now to Carla Lockhart, Democratic Unionist Party MP for Upper Ban. Carla, thank you very much for joining us on Bloomberg Westminster. Do you agree with Liz Truss? Can the problems be solved?
Absolutely. The protocol has caused both economic and constitutional difficulties for the people of Northern Ireland. It is increasing the cost of goods here in Northern Ireland. And also we have people like the Road Haulage Association hauliers saying that costs are increasing to bring goods from GB to Northern Ireland by about 27%. And in fact, it's probably more around 34%. Increase in cost. This needs fixed. We need the UK government to act. We have obviously had statement from Liz Truss in the House 2 weeks ago now. That was welcome, but we need to see action. We want to see the bill laid in Parliament and we want to see Northern Ireland's economic and constitutional place within the United Kingdom restored.
Okay. The law that is being proposed by the government, by Liz Truss, it would essentially unilaterally change the protocol. Everybody has warned against this, that this could effectively create a trade dispute, a trade war with the EU. Is that going too far to fix the issues?
Absolutely not. And the EU need to dial down the rhetoric around trade wars, etc. That's an absolute farcical situation and it is not at all an outworking of the UK government's action. The UK government recognise Northern Ireland as an integral part of the United Kingdom. We want them to restore the wrongs that have been done in Northern Ireland. It is just crazy that you can't bring, you know, a tree from GB to Northern Ireland because it might have a speck of soil on it. And there's lots of examples that we can give. Northern Ireland, its biggest market is GB, and therefore we need frictionless trade. We need the Irish Sea border to go. We believe that the bill being proposed will resolve many of the issues, and therefore we're encouraging the government not to just go with words this time, but take action, introduce the bill, and get it through Parliament.
Carla, the EU has already laid out four areas where they're willing to negotiate, and that would cover those issues about plants, for example, as SPS checks. They've also laid out plans of how that, you know, paperwork could be reduced. There could be enhanced engagement with stakeholders in Northern Ireland. The issues around medicines could be that exemption could be extended. The EU, from their point of view, says they've given four ideas for how things could be tackled, and the UK government isn't engaging. They say the UK government are the ones that aren't being flexible.
No, well, the UK government have highlighted on numerous occasions, all throughout the negotiations, the problems that this is causing to the people of Northern Ireland, the impact that it's having, say, for instance, on the cost of living in Northern Ireland. And the EU have done very little get a way through. We're asking our UK government to act, because they know the longer that this goes on, the more it impacts the people of Northern Ireland. The UK government, the ball is at their toe now. They need to take action.
If the issues that your party has with this are resolved, are you committed to going back into a power-sharing government in Stormont?
We are a party that believes in devolution. We want to see the institutions restored. My party leader ran an election campaign just over a month ago at this stage. And our mandate was to ensure, A, that the protocol is fixed, and then B, return to Stormont and implement our five-point plan. We're committed to that, but at this point, our mandate is very much to hold the line. Don't return to Stormont until the protocol issues are resolved.
But are you worried that that could damage your party as well? Because, I mean, you lost seats in the last election. Support in your constituency for the DUP was down by about 5%. People are shifting to parties like Alliance. Public support, a study from the Queen's University Belfast showing that public support for the protocol has more than doubled from a year ago. There are now on balance more people in support of it than against it. Is this the issue? Surely people want the government in place in Northern Ireland to tackle things like the cost of living crisis.
But if you take the cost of living issue, you know, we can't benefit from the fleet of measures that the UK government are likely to introduce even today in the House. We haven't been able to benefit from previous interventions because of the protocol. So it's
but that's because your party won't go into power-sharing government. You know, that
that is in your power. That is because Northern Ireland remains part of the EU single market, and therefore that regime is different for Northern Ireland. And what the UK government have implemented, we cannot benefit. If Stormont was up in the morning, we still couldn't benefit from it because of the outworkings of the protocol. So it's absolutely wrong to say that if Stormont was there in the morning, it would resolve issues like that. We want to see Stormont up and running for the devolved issues. But the protocol is a national issue. The protocol is about the United Kingdom, and Northern Ireland remains part of the United Kingdom, and therefore it is up to our UK government to act. In relation to the DUP, we received a large mandate at the last election. And if you look at Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland is built on consensus. Northern Ireland prides itself in the Good Friday Agreement and the Belfast Agreement, and that is all around consensus government. One unionist party agree to the protocol. Not one unionist party. So all of the unionists that were elected to the Northern Ireland Assembly in the election on the 5th of May don't support this protocol. Therefore, you know, it doesn't fit with the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement.
Okay, Carla Lockhart, DUP MP for Upper Ban. Thank you very much for speaking to us on Bloomberg Westminster.
So let's turn our attention now to something actually that's rather close to my heart, living here in London. Transport for London has extended its e-scooter trial scheme until November 2022. It's due to end in June. And I want to talk to Labour's London Assembly transport spokesperson, Ellie Baker, about it. Ellie, thank you so much for being with us. Look, I'm fascinated that this trial has been extended. What do you think the benefits of this e-scooter trial have actually been so far? I know that there is still an investigation and there's going to be kind of monitoring of how the trial has gone, but this is a huge change to London's roads, and I'm fascinated to understand how you see it.
Thanks for having me to talk about this. E-scooters have become really a divisive issue, but there's a real opportunity to have a balanced debate around them, balanced debate about transport in our city overall, and listening to all perspectives. And we have seen, very recently, significant numbers of collisions, particularly data that's come through from last year from the Met Police. And at the moment, we can't conclusively tell if this is from the illegal e-scooter use, which obviously is really unhelpful on our streets and pavements, or the safer hired e-scooters on the TfL trial. But what we have the opportunity, what TfL's trials give us the opportunity to do, is really dig into what the benefits might be, what the drawbacks are, and what contribution, if any, e-scooters could make to our transport ecosystem in London. And it's really an opportunity to listen to all stakeholders in London, whether they're using e-scooters or whether they're not, road users and pedestrians, and really carefully consider the impact that we might have if we have more e-scooters on the streets.
Yeah, and for anyone who doesn't know what those figures are, they've been reported by a number of newspapers, but the Department for Transport figures show that the number of pedestrians injured after being hit by e-scooters was 4 times higher in 2021 than in the previous year. 223 people, that's a lot.
How do you balance that then with the transport? I mean, how do you balance that against any advantages?
So, well, we have to look at what the advantages might be. That's what we can do. So, are people using that? Are people using e-scooters instead of getting in cars? That may be the case. I'm maybe a little bit doubtful of that. Is it getting people around to do essential jobs and essential work and making people more mobile? Is it a form of transport that maybe is not as accessible to so many people? So actually, it's taking up road space that might be used for other forms. These are all the things we need to look at. And there's not really, I don't think, a settled view on all of this, although some people may say so. So it's really an opportunity to listen to people more and see what the impact would be, because the collision data is worrying, and quite reasonably older people and many disabled people would be affected by more e-scooters, and we need to put that in context of any advantage there might be.
There were 63 people, though, who were seriously injured on the roads because of those collisions. I mean, surely something that needs to be looked at kind of before the end of the trial is the speed at which e-scooters are going, and also that there's a split, isn't there, between private e-scooters on the roads and the ones that are for rent.
Yes, absolutely. So there's no doubt that the ones that are for hire as part of the Transport for London trial are safer, of a safer design than the vast majority of the illegal e-scooters. Their speed is limited. They have lights on them, and you know, we can look at sounds, audio sounds, so that people with any visual impairments will be able to see them. So there's an opportunity there to see whether we can improve the design, and that significantly impacts the amount of collisions there are. But obviously the government are looking at regulation around e-scooters because of the amount of e-scooters are on the road. But as part of that discussion, we need to talk about the design and make them look at whether we can make them as safe as possible, but also look at this question of whether they are inherently a good thing for us, or whether they are going to cause more accidents and not benefit our transport overall. I mean, at a time where we're actually seeing public transport funding cuts, which is obviously much more accessible than an e-scooter. Lots more people can use a bus than can use an e-scooter. You've got to think about whether this is a priority for us.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.